I've been told that the microphone was planned for a taller speaker, so I'll do my best. Too late to grow any more inches. The 4th of July was always one of my favorite holidays as a child in post-war America and the Eisenhower years. In my native New England, there were no parades. That was for Memorial Day. But there were fireworks and flags and picnics and my uncle's corn. I suppose there were speeches, but my childhood was unmarred by television, so I didn't know about them. In school, we were urged to be patriotic. We said the pledge to the flag every day. But we were spared the challenge of singing the national anthem. Thank goodness. I have to say Finland's national anthem, which we just sung to our own words, is a lot more singable. We put covers on our textbooks with patriotic symbols and pictures of dead presidents and patriotic quotations. We learned that being an American was about God, motherhood, and apple pie, and later we added Coca-Cola and Chevrolet. We had a sense that America was number one because actually, at that time, it did appear that America was number one. That didn't begin to change until Sputnik went up when I was in high school. I didn't know whether it was a simpler world or whether it just seemed like a simpler world because I was a child. In school, we learned the standard account of American history, glossing over the treatment of Native Americans, George Washington's extravagant expense account, and the good luck and foreign help that got us through the Revolution. The Civil War was a jumble of slavery and states' rights and battles and the Emancipation Proclamation. It was decades later when I heard of, the female heroes of abolition like Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth and the Grimke sisters, or about sharecropping and lynching in the ugly aftermath of the Civil War. I didn't learn to call it the war between the states until I moved to South Carolina. We did read Uncle Tom's Cabin because Harriet Beecher Stowe came from a prominent Connecticut family, but even though I was born in the Connecticut hometown of abolitionist John Brown, he was not regarded as a local hero. The Trail of Tears and its connection to gold mining, never heard of it. America's semi-colonial ventures in the Caribbean and Central America and Hawaii and the Philippines, barely mentioned. Nothing about our refusal to help rescue the Jews during World War II or the internment of the Japanese. It was a very sanitized history, devoid of alternative facts, or at least additional facts and alternative interpretations. It changed when I was in my 20s. No, it didn't change because I read Howard Zinn's version of U.S. history that came much later. It was Vietnam. Vietnam divided Americans like never before. Was it patriotic to fight in the Vietnam War? Was it patriotic to protest it? What if the answer to both questions was yes? Were the Barrican brothers who released the Pentagon Papers patriots or traitors? Obviously, the leadership of the Unitarian Universalist Association thought they were patriots because Beacon Press was the only publishing house willing to publish the Pentagon Papers. My one tiny act of patriotic courage was to be a presenter in a teach-in at Clemson University against the Vietnam War when I was just a 27-year-old, untenured part-time assistant professor. The administration, relieved that we were engaging in such a civilized form of protest while other universities were erupting in violence, just patted us on the head and went on about its business of producing ROTC cadets to go to Vietnam. My children were too young to remember the Vietnam War. It was Iraq and the non-existent weapons of mass destruction that led them to rethink their understanding of patriotism. And by the way, my home congregation, UFC, also has a theme of patriotism today, and one of the three speakers is my oldest daughter, who is a political activist. But for me, the 4th of July has never been the same since Vietnam. As I continue to hear alternative readings of history, as I did my recent trip to Cuba, it led me to question the patriotism, or at least the reasoning, what were they thinking, of those who are running our government during some of our less noble episodes, from Reconstruction and its aftermath to empire building in the Caribbean and the Pacific to Vietnam, Iraq, and Syria. So my question for you today is twofold. First, what is patriotism and why should we march under its banner? Second, what does patriotism call us to do as citizens and as Unitarian Universalists whose principles affirm the goal of world community? In order to answer those questions, we have to start out with the idea of our understanding of the moral universe, which I got from an Australian philosopher and ethicist whom you may have heard of. His name is Peter Singer. Peter Singer believes that everyone in the world has an equal right to our love, compassion, resources, and attention. We should not be giving preferential treatment to our fellow citizens or even our own immediate family. His moral universe is very fat and very wide and very unnerving. I don't think in practice he takes it to quite that extreme because he does seem to have a wife and children. But at least he asks us to decide who lies within our own moral universes. So it's an interesting question. Who's in your moral universe? Which is a landscape that describes to whom and for whom you are responsible and accountable and to what degree. I used to assign this topic, I taught ethics and public policy for 15 years, and I used to assign this topic as a reflection paper once a week, one week each semester, and I got really interesting answers. None of them went the Peter Singer route. They didn't believe they were equally responsible to and for everybody. A starving child in your household was no more important than a starving child in the South Sudan. They also didn't do the narrow one, which a lot of people do, which is me, my family, and maybe a few friends and relatives. In general, it was not a tight circle in my moral universe, outside my moral universe. I know, by the way, that cockroaches are outside my moral universe, but, and a few other people. But it's more like a series of concentric circles with less and less obligation as you get farther and farther out, because none of us can take care of everybody's needs. So you have to have a hierarchy, starting with yourself and your immediate family. The important thing is it doesn't end there. Sometimes the boundaries, as well as the degree of obligation, are decided by nearness and distance. It may be geographic, it may be kinship, but those are two of the criteria we often use. Or it may be decided by an expectation of reciprocity in forms ranging from casseroles to NATO. Or as Yogi Berra famously said, you have to go to other people's funerals, otherwise they won't go to yours. Yogi's a real brain tease, I gotta tell you. All too often we set tight boundaries in terms of us versus them because we'll feel more connected and therefore obligated to those with whom we share DNA, age, gender, race, sexual orientation, ethnicity, language, or class. In fact, we're seeing a revival of tribalism defined by those shared characteristics. We see it in gated communities and private schools, and in class-segregated neighborhoods and ghettos. We listen to those who are like us and screen out those who are different. This attitude has created an ongoing battle for us as Unitarian Universalists because we're trying to swim against the current of a society that prefers building walls to building bridges. Reevaluating our moral universe means coming to terms with that constant tension between the joy of bonding with those who are like us and the moral imperative of building bridges. International relations are all about how far we, as a government, as a nation, stretch the boundaries of our moral universe. What do we owe to citizens of other countries? Surely they have some role in our moral universe, as we hope they have us in their moral universe, that is to come to each other's aid in disaster, to work toward common goals like protecting the planet that transcend national boundaries, to treat each other's cultures and the integrity of their boundaries with respect. Many of us, I'm sure many in this room, support private nonprofits like the UU and American Friends Service Committees or CARE or the Red Cross. And in their humanity work of offering friendship, aid, and assistance to victims of disasters, to refugees, to those who need a boost in health and education. We encourage our governments to support those kinds of aids, but those actions are not grounded in patriotism, but simply on an understanding of our moral universe. Patriotism means we actually draw a boundary around shared citizenship. Patriotism is tribal loyalty, identity, a feeling of mutual obligations between citizens who share a government. Patriotism draws a boundary around our nation's borders and says our primary or maybe even only commitment to loyalty and civic duty lies inside that boundary. And there's other boundaries as well. Do I owe more to the citizens of South Carolina than North Carolina? Yeah, I do, because we share a government and an education system and a highway system. We've got lots of common stuff we have to take care of. We're jointly responsible for them, and we have a shared history that we sometimes try to live up to and other times we try to live down, depending on which part it is. Do I have more responsibilities to the citizens of Clemson than the rest of the state? Yes, because we have shared commons, the roads, the schools, the city bus system, the zoning regulations. So my voice will be heard because I'm a citizen and a voter. But that doesn't mean I don't have responsibilities for the rest of the state or the rest of the United States, because we too have a shared government. So patriotism calls on us both to believe in and affirm the governments we elect, and at the same time to try to make them better, more responsive, more transparent, more accountable, and more inclusive. It doesn't exclude non-citizens or other countries from our moral universe. It just means our obligations we choose to assume for them are based on something other than patriotism. It also means that that distinct obligation to our fellow citizens of the city, state, or nation is limited to civic participation. Patriotism means we vote, we pay taxes, we call our legislators, we try to understand the issues. And we try to take into account the needs of all of our fellow citizens, not just our own. Loyalty to family and friends and other entities, like your school, your congregation, or your faith tradition, are like patriotism. That is, it should not be blind. We can affirm our loyalty in many ways, including loving criticism. That's also true of our country. We can honor those who serve in the military or in public office and praise the good work that they do. But we can also serve by offering thoughtful, informed, constructive criticism and by paying attention. It is patriotic to vote. It is patriotic to care. It is patriotic to speak out and speak up. In North Carolina, a group of activist voters, as I'm sure you all well know, led by Reverend William Barber, has been taking that patriotic responsibility very seriously with Moral Mondays. Many of you, I'm sure, have heard the toast by Stephen Decatur, "My country, right or wrong." That wasn't the whole toast. The rest of it was, he added, "If she is right, if she is wrong, may we make her right." Mark Twain said that patriotism is supporting your country all of the time and your government when it deserves it. So we first affirm that we identify as Americans. We are proud to be Americans. We recognize the good things we as a nation have done for each other, from public education to Social Security to the interstate highway system and the Civil Rights Act. And then we try to make it better. We try to make it live up to that affirmation. It's kind of like being parents with bright but lazy students. I've had some of those. We affirm their capabilities and even their good intentions, and then we try to get them to improve their performance. Positive parenting is kind of a mirror side of positive patriotism. A particular form of patriotism is found in our fifth principle, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process. The right of conscience is tied to freedom of speech and assembly. It implies the responsibility of conscience, the duty to act when conscience dictates action. As you use, we are also called to do so without violence and with respect for those with whom we disagree, difficult as that may sometimes be. As for democratic process, that's where the two organizations that I treasure most converge, Unitarian Universalism and the League of Women Voters. What was not in my introduction is that as of June 1st, I became the co-president of the League of Women Voters of South Carolina. And it's very exciting and very challenging. The League supports and affirms active and informed citizen participation in government. We register voters, advertise elections, hold candidate forums, and work to ensure that everybody has the chance to vote. In between, we study public issues, follow legislation, and lobby. While we have positions on a lot of issues, the election process and the right to vote are at the core of what we do, making sure that the election process is fair and now not hacked, that people know their right to vote and we protect it, and insisting that states draw fair district lines that are fair to both parties and all groups, including minorities. So that's how I exercise my patriotic duty. It's not the only way. It's not maybe even the best way, but it's my way. Others, like my daughter, prefer to advocate early and often. Every Tuesday, she calls her members of Congress and tells them how they should vote. Her success rate has not been real high, but she keeps calling. Many of us work for candidates or serve on zoning boards or volunteer in city recreation programs. However we do it, we need to act on a basis of information after a free and responsible search for truth. Wow, I've worked three principles in that. That's a new record. Okay, so this Independence Day, as we celebrate our nation's 241st birthday, I urge you to find a way to practice positive patriotism. For my part, I think I will thank a public official. And I've got a particular one in mind. I've been a public official. I served on city council, so I know how difficult it can be. So I will probably go to my state legislature, my state senator, and my state representative. I'm not quite ready to do that with my members of Congress. I think I'll just concentrate on those two. And having affirmed, I will promise to stay in touch, to know what's going on, and to let them know what I think in a positive way about the gas tax or the bus routes or healthcare or food stamps or the rising cost of higher education. And also to let them know that I'm not speaking only out of my own self-interest, but out of concern for fellow citizens with different and usually more urgent needs. It is our responsibility and our privilege as patriots to encourage everyone, leaders and followers, to live up to our national covenant as set forth in the preamble to the Constitution. They called it a preamble. I call it a covenant. It says, and it's in your bulletin, we the people created this Constitution and this government in order to, quote, form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Here is my invitation or my challenge. The most patriotic thing you can do to honor the 4th of July is not to wave a flag or host a picnic or watch the fireworks, which are all good things to do, but to resolve to find your own path to positive patriotism and put it into practice. The best time is right now. May it be so.